Hello, everyone, and welcome to the CIO House View monthly live stream. Today is Thursday, September 5th, 2024. I'm Anthony Pastore here in our New York studios. Thanks so much for joining us for this live stream. So today I'm joined by my two CIO colleagues, David Lefkowitz and Kurt Ryman. We're going to get to talking to the gentleman in just a moment, but first we always want to remind you that we appreciate hearing from you, our live audience. So if you click that Ask a Question button on your screen at any time between now and the remainder of this live stream, you'll be able to engage with us here in the studio, ask any questions you like, and we'll do our best to get to as many of them as we can. So we'll open up those lines in just a moment. In the meantime, anything we talk about today, of course, we encourage you to follow up this conversation with your financial advisor. All right, so let's get into it. David, I thought maybe we could kind of kick things off with you. Good to see you, by the way.
Yeah, likewise.
Welcome back. Great seeing you. You know, it's been an interesting month. The last time we were here on the 1st of August, the Thursday, it was right before we got the jobs numbers that was a catalyst for a lot of the volatility that we saw in the beginning of August. And so now here we are, a little volatility this past week. But we've got a decent amount of economic data that we've just received. And you and I and Kurt were just talking about how markets really are looking at every single data point as we're anticipating what the Fed's going to do. So talk about the data that we just got, jobless claims. We're expecting jobs numbers tomorrow from the Labor Department. How is this all affecting or potentially impacting performance on the equity side?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, it's clear that the economy is cooling, which is sort of what the Fed wanted to see in order to get inflation under control. But I would say, you know, we're seeing cooling, but we're not seeing cracking, right? We got the unemployment claims that came out this morning. They were actually down very, very slightly, but, you know, more or less they've been flattish over the last several weeks. I mean, that's one of the best, timeliest indicators of what's happening in the labor market. And I think the market is rightly focused on the labor market, because that's usually where you would want to look at to see if we're heading into a recession or not. So I think, you know, what's been restraining the economy, it's really, in our view, it's just been these very high interest rates relative to inflation, right? I mean, the Fed obviously jacked rates up quite aggressively a couple of years ago. You know, we now have a Fed funds rate that is between 5.25 and 5.5. And yet at the same time, inflation has come down pretty nicely. It's running around 2.5, 2.75. So there's a pretty big spread now between the Fed funds rate and inflation. And that looks like it is having an impact on certainly the rate sensitive parts of the economy. So there's an easy solution here. The Fed can start cutting rates, as you were talking about. And we think Jay Powell, the chairman of the Fed, has indicated that they are going to start cutting rates. There's some questions about the pace of that and how quickly and how big they'll be. But bottom line is, we think as they start cutting rates, that's going to do a lot to help extend this expansion. So we're not looking for a recession. Still think a soft landing, in other words, economy slowing down but not cratering, is the base case. The other thing I would point out is that we don't see big imbalances in the economy, right? If you look at household balance sheets, you know, consumers are in pretty good shape from a leverage standpoint, financial leverage. Very much the same can be said about corporations as well, that they haven't taken on too much excessiveness in terms of debt. And we don't see big imbalances in terms of overinvestment in certain pockets of the economy. You know, just a very different situation than if you kind of rewind the clock and look at some of the past recessions, like during the housing bubble or during the tech bubble, where balance sheets were much more stretched, there were bigger pockets of overinvestment in the economy that needed to be wrung out. So, you know, we think as the Fed starts cutting rates, expansion continues. And one of the interesting data points that I think is helpful to think about is that when the Fed has cut interest rates in the context of no recession, which has happened 4 or 5 times in the last 50 years, U.S. equities usually do quite well. Mm-hmm. In the subsequent 12 months, stocks are up on average about 17%. So, you know, I do think the rate cuts are going to be an important part of the story to extend this expansion, but that is our base case, and we think the bull market is still intact.
Right. And we'll get to this volatility we're seeing in the mega cap tech names in a moment, because that's also a part of the story.
Yep.
you can't really tell one part without telling the other. But Kurt, let me ask you, because, you know, David's talking about the Fed, and we're always talking about the Fed, what the Fed will do. As of right now, our economist, Brian Rose, expects 100 basis points before the end of the year. The next Fed meeting's on September 18th. And also, we had the Fed Beige Book released yesterday, and it's a survey of 12 districts within the U.S. And interestingly, only, I think it was nine out of the 12 districts did report some slowdown in economic activity. Still expanding, but at a slower pace. Jobs were slower. So there's a lot that the FOMC has to consider before the next meeting on the 18th. What are your thoughts, and what can we maybe expect from them between September 18th and the end of the year?
Right. So our forecast, as you point out, as David has mentioned, is for the Fed to cut rates by a full percentage point. And the data supporting that. Since the last time that they issued a summary of economic projections back in June, the data's clearly slowed. And it's given them the recipe for being able to start this rate cutting cycle. But I think it's also important to reflect on just how long they've kept the policy rate where it is since their last rate hike. And that's at 13 months. It's the second longest. And since we've been looking back, the longest is 15 months. So they've kept policy rates at a restrictive level, to David's point earlier. If inflation falls and the policy rate doesn't move, the policy rate becomes ever more restrictive. So the big picture is they're cutting rates this year. And if you look back at the June summary of economic projections, there were still four members that were voting that rates weren't going to come down this year at all. So there's been a big change. Some of that's been priced in. We expect the rate cuts to continue into 2025. So that's and another 100 basis points. So that's 2 percentage points off of where we are now. I take the message from that, especially as David laid out, with this being not a hard landing, not a recession, still being a soft landing, slower growth environment, is that this is time to put cash to work. This is a policy rate that will be, in a year and a half's time, quite a bit lower than where it is today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're coming out of we will be coming out of a period where, you know, you were getting 5 to 6, sometimes 7% on a high yield, cash account, whether it was a CD or something along those lines. But as we predict, with 200 basis points between now and next year, that's not going to be the case anymore. So flipping though to the fixed income investors that are out there, they've had opportunities for much higher yields on many of the different products within the asset class. What do you recommend to investors today, fixed income investors, given where we expect rates will be going over the next 18 months or so?
Sure. So the rates that the Fed rate cuts, these are pretty well priced at this point.
Yeah.
We've had a really good run in the bond market. We had been calling for a bull steepener, so front end rates falling more than longer term interest rates. That's played out. Mm-hmm. We were overweight bonds in our asset allocation. We had a preference for mortgage-backed securities within our fixed income preferences and also higher quality bonds. We've changed that as a result of this move in the bond market. It's been impressive. We have a 3.5% to 4% range short term on the 10-year Treasury note yield, and we're below 380. So we're pretty near the, just moving towards the lower end of that range. I would say that this is not the time to be extending duration. This would be a time to neutralize that posture, to hold bonds that are more in the intermediate part of the curve, but also to think about that credit enhancement, the additional yield pickup. Where are you seeking that? Mortgage-backed securities did very well. That's not a place anymore that we think that there's outsized opportunities. But we still think that investment-grade corporates present still a very good opportunity. And why is that? Well, yields are still in the high fours, which I think is a decent number when you consider rate cuts, when you consider the 10-year note yield, where it is. I would also be thinking about how do investment-grade corporates perform in a softish economic environment, or how might they perform in a risk case where we would end up having potentially a contraction in economic activity. Mm. Investment-grade corporates would perform better than high yield, and they tend to have a little bit less volatility in the credit spectrum. So we still like high-quality bonds, but we've neutralized that overweight on bonds, and we've brought our mortgage-backed securities overweight down to neutral. And I'd say, yeah, not a good time to be too far out the curve. Just keep that neutral position.
Right. It's sort of another way for me to ask you the question, how do you feel about duration right now in this environment?
Right. So we don't want to go
too far
over our ski tips.
Right.
There might be a time, though, when would that be? Looking at 10-year note yields, if they were ever to move back towards 4.25%, 4.5%, we wouldn't rule that out. That's perfectly reasonable, especially with the volatility that we've seen in the bond market. We could hit that destination, and if we do, look to us to re-engage with a bit of a longer maturity profile.
Yeah, exactly. Good reason for people to tune in every month to this live stream, right? And we're looking at, by the way, the 10-year yield and the 2-year yield. They're about the same right now, 373, 374. And we've been looking at an inverted yield curve for such a long time now. To see them come a little bit closer, it'll be interesting to see how this plays out over the next couple of months.
Yeah,
Fed cuts.
Actually, to that point, you don't get paid to go too far out in duration, right? But you do get paid if you're thinking about where cash rate's going. You do get paid to think about extending from cash and into some of the short to intermediate parts of the curve.
Yeah, those higher yields are not going to be around for much longer on the cash side.
Our forecast is correct.
That's right, exactly.
The market's correct.
We suppose.
That's right.
So, David, back to you for a second. I did tease the old idea of the mega cap tech stocks. If anybody's been paying attention this week, there was a decent amount of volatility on that side of the equity story. What do you think is really the cause of the volatility? And I will do a follow-up with you on that, which is the people now investors might be saying, well, is the AI trade overblown, or is this a bit of like maybe a hiccup for the moment? Where do you see that?
Yeah, sure. So, I think there were a couple things that have been driving the volatility. I mean, we did get some weaker economic data. That was a bit of that caused a little bit of volatility. You know, the other thing, which didn't get a lot of attention so much in the press, but it does speak to one of the risks that we are thinking about on the horizon in the next few weeks, is that China made a comment that they would retaliate if Japan put some restrictions on their ability to use some of the semiconductor equipment that's coming from Japan. You know, so the U.S. has been very focused on trying to restrict access to U.S. technology in the semiconductor space. The Japanese government is sort of working with the U.S. government on that. So it just, I think, reminded the market that we're probably going to get some further export restrictions on U.S. chips probably before the middle of October. So that could cause a little bit of volatility as well. You know, we've seen this in the past. It hasn't really had a huge impact on the results of these semiconductor companies, but could provide some, you know, could offer some volatility perhaps. And the other thing, you know, we just have to be aware, seasonality, you know, it's hard to explain why this happens, but it is true that September tends to be the most negative month, or has the lowest returns out of any month in the calendar. And maybe that was a factor that got people a little bit worried as we hit the first trading day in September. So, you know, we put a little defensiveness into our own portfolios towards the end of August. We added some utilities. You know, we were just, and also we didn't even talk about the election, but, you know, election uncertainty as well. So, you know, a number of things that could lead to a little bit of volatility, but we don't think it's going to be long-lasting or derail the bull market. Now, in terms of more, a little bit more detail on tech, yeah, look, I mean, AI is clearly been such a huge story in the markets the last couple of years. You know, we think those trends remain very much intact. You know, these companies, the biggest companies that are spending the most amount of money, they made it very clear during second quarter earnings season that they view this technology as almost existential. If they're not in a pole position or have a leading position in certain parts of this technology, they think their core business is at risk. And so what does that mean? That just means they're going to keep on spending. And also bear in mind that each generation of these models is so much more compute intensive than the next generation, right? So, you know, Mark Zuckerberg at Meta has talked about the next version of their model is going to take 10 times the compute that the current generation does. And these models are coming out next year, which is also another catalyst, right, that we you know, I think it's important to kind of keep on the horizon there.
And there's a whole separate conversation happening on the energy side, like where are we going to get all the energy to produce,
right,
and also the water to cool all the machines in the data centers that are actually functioning to make this happen.
Tremendous amount of capital and investment is going to be needed to do this. But we think the productivity gains are very much real and certainly have a lot of potential. I mean, right now, we're seeing huge gains in terms of software developers, right? You're seeing 30 to 50% improvement in productivity in software development. You know, I know we're trialing some of our tools internally here at UBS that we're going to be rolling out to a larger pool of the employee base over the coming months. You talk to any Fortune 500 company, they're all trying to figure out their AI strategy. I just, you know, venture community is all in on this, right? I mean, there's just a tremendous amount of capital that's trying to be deployed to take advantage of the opportunity from these new technologies. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just don't think we're still in the early innings of this.
Right.
And I think that still should be a good driver for US markets, which are pretty leveraged to AI in general. You know, tech has become such a big weight in the S&P 500 that, this is definitely an important part of the story, but we're still pretty constructive on it.
Excellent. Thank you, David. Before I continue on with our conversation, just to remind our audience, if you'd like to ask a question, click the Ask a Question button on your screen, and we'll get that here in the room to us. So please feel free to ask away, and we'll get to those questions in a couple of minutes. So you said the election word. I said the big E word.
Right.
Of course we're going to talk about the election, since here we are. It's post-Labor Day. We're running up to the first debate between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris. And then we've got early voting actually starting pretty soon in a number of states, with, of course, Election Day happening in November. So let me ask you both, and Kurt, maybe I'll start with you, since you're also one of the co-authors of our Election Watch series here at UBS and in CIO. What are you going to be paying attention to next week during that debate between former President Trump and Vice President Harris? I think a lot of people are going to be looking to see if they're going to have more information on some of the policies that they're going to be presenting to the American people. But what else, besides that, and maybe that's one of the things you're looking at, what are you really going to be looking for?
Well, as a scene setter, I'd say this is, I mean, we're going into this debate. It's a toss-up. It's an incredibly tight race.
Yes.
And that's true not just in the popular vote, but especially in the swing states. It's incredibly narrow. The Harris has clawed back a lot of the momentum that was lost after that first debate between Biden and Trump. And so we go into this next debate on the 10th with, I think, both candidates having to speak to that independent that sits in a swing state that can be convinced to move in one direction or the other. Because we know that the view on Trump for most of his base is fixed.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew that that was also true for Biden. Harris had optionality, and we've seen her favorability ratings move considerably higher just in the last month and a half. So that's, I think, where the debate is going to be centered. I would expect that Trump will use this as an opportunity to paint and link Harris to the inflation rates under the Biden-Harris administration post-pandemic. I think he will also look to label her with the porous border and the policies of that administration. And I think he's going to act tough on foreign policy. That's what I would expect.
Mm-hmm.
From a Harris administration, I think she will look to build upon her record supporting reproductive rights. I think there's a big contrast, as we know, between the two candidates on a range of issues. So even though they may be, you know, neck and neck in the polls, their policies are very wide. And
mm-hmm.
so I would expect, in the case of Harris, maybe an effort on the tax side to start to migrate a bit more towards the center, if that's, you know, where she tax. We saw that with the capital gains tax announcement yesterday. We've seen that with some of the support around expansion of the child tax credit. we may see more of that. But I think that's really where this is going to be fought, is over independent voters in swing states. They are going to be the audience that the candidates are going to be trying to speak to.
Yeah, most of the major polls are showing anywhere between 5 to 8% of the voters in the U.S. who are expected to turn out to vote are still undecided. So this debate is really crucial for both campaigns in one way or the other to get people to know who they both are. David, on the equity side, is there anything that, you know, debate-wise, I don't know if there's anything specific that you're going to be looking for investing-wise. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think we have to separate sort of what we hear during the campaign rhetoric and what ultimately might become policy after the election. But clearly the big swing points for the equity markets are going to be what happens on tariffs, especially if Trump is back in office. That could pose some risk to equity markets. And then what happens on taxes and just fiscal policy in general. So any clarity that we get from either candidate on how important these particular policies are to them, that could be helpful. But look, I mean, obviously the composition of Congress is going to be very important in terms of what actually gets implemented. So I don't think we're going to, I don't think the equity market is going to react so dramatically to the debate. I think it's going to be more about the election and the ultimate composition of Washington as we go into next year.
Yeah, excellent. Thank you, David. We are starting to get questions in the room, which we'll get to here in a moment. But Kurt, I just wanted to sort of get your, maybe you sort of answered this a little bit, but as we're in the home stretch, and as I mentioned, we do have some states starting their early voting very soon, within the next 2 weeks or so. What do you think of about the race as we enter this home stretch to Election Day after Labor Day? Like you said, it's tight. And we still have the debate, but is there anything that you can say to us is here's really what we expect or what we're looking for?
Well,
in the next six weeks or so.
If past is prologue, then we can have quite a bit of a change between now and Election Day. It's one of the most eventful campaigns and that I've been witness to, and this can very much change as we go through into these last 8 weeks until Election Day. Right now, our scenarios would suggest that Kamala Harris has a slight advantage, 55% to 45% Harris versus Trump. And then in the, thinking about David's point about divided government versus united government, we have that at about a 50-50 split. So this is an election that's still very much up for grabs. It's going to be fought very much in the battleground states. The Harris campaign is trying to see if it can pick up some momentum in North Carolina and in Georgia. And the Trump administration is recently, the Trump campaign is very much looking at Pennsylvania right now as still being very much in play. So both candidates have a lot of work ahead of them. A lot can change. But right now our odds would slightly favor a Harris presidency. At 55 versus 45.
Right. I'm not a betting man, but certainly I would expect that there are going to be a lot of viewers watching the debate next week for those exact reasons. It's just so new. I mean, the Harris campaign has only been going at this for about a month and a half or so. And so it'll be really interesting to see where they go. Before we get to the questions, David, just from the portfolio side of the story, we always say don't go to the voting booths voting for your portfolio, vote for the candidate that you want to win. Mm-hmm. So what do you say to investors out there who are concerned about the election one way or the other?
I think just to reiterate what you said, I would encourage people to express a political view at the ballot box, not in their portfolio.
That's right.
Because elections... there can be some volatility, especially within the market itself, depending on who the relative winners and losers might be from specific policies, but usually it doesn't have a dramatic impact on the overall market. There are exceptions, but usually we don't see dramatically negative reactions. So I think that's an important thing to bear in mind. So look, be prepared for some volatility, and markets don't like uncertainty, and we are entering a period where we have a little bit more uncertainty around what specific policies will be in place as we go into 2025. And if we do see pullbacks, use that as an opportunity to start adding to positions. As I mentioned, We did add a little bit of defensiveness in our sector positioning. So we still like tech. We like financials. We added a position in utilities, which is a really, you know, one of the most defensive sectors out there. Also has some AI tailwinds in it as well, but really the defensiveness is its primary attribute. So yeah, we think that's a little bit prudent as we go into this seasonally more challenging time, a little bit more uncertainty, but I think that's going to be relatively short-lived, and I think stocks will be higher before the end of the year and as we go into 2025.
Yeah, that's excellent. Great advice, David. And the other advice we always say is make sure you're having an open dialogue with your financial advisor so that you can look at your portfolio from that lens that David is talking about instead of the lens that has to do with who's going to win the election or any other factors that might be going on in the world. So, David, thank you. All right, so let's get to some audience questions. David, since we're already speaking, well, there's two questions here, and they may be related. But let me ask you the first one. The question is, what areas of the equity market are overlooked by investors related to artificial intelligence? Is there anything out there that is being overlooked?
I think the market's been pretty efficient about this. Obviously, semiconductor supply chain, some of the big tech companies do have leading positions in the applications, the models themselves. Mm-hmm. I think this is all well understood. You've seen pretty big moves in anything data center related. You mentioned sort of the power needs and things like that. So, it seems like I wouldn't say there are things that have been really overlooked, but that doesn't mean that we can't see further gains. I mean, I think there's a good chance that a lot of the leading companies in many of those segments I just talked about end up beating expectations when it comes to earnings as we go into next year. And so I think there still are positive catalysts as we look out over the next 12 months. Blackwell hasn't even been rolled out yet. We haven't yet seen GPT-5, which probably is coming in the next, maybe not before the end of the year, but probably early next year. Who knows? It's going to be in the next several months. I mean, these are all positive things that I think are going to continue to have investors focused on the upside opportunity. I would say, there's also risks, right? I mean, we haven't yet seen how this technology could disrupt certain incumbents, right? So I think that story has yet to be written because we don't really have a clear conviction on what the applications are and will there be new companies. I mean, it's an interesting statistic that, so little of the current market cap in the internet was founded, was a lot of it. I mean, when did Google go public? Netscape went public in 95, right? I mean, a lot of the behemoths that we think of today didn't go public until 5 or 10 years after Netscape had its IPO, right? So we're in store for a lot of change, certainly if the technology lives up to our expectations. So, but I think the way to be positioned is right now the clearest place to be. The most direct beneficiaries are the companies that have leading positions in that infrastructure part of the technology, and that's where we would focus investments.
It's such an interesting point that you made. Is there maybe needs that we don't even know exist yet, and who's going to fulfill those needs? It might be new companies or existing companies. So yeah, fascinating stuff, David, and an ever-evolving story, as you said. Kurt, where on the curve, this is a question for you about the fixed income side, where on the curve should municipal bond investors position themselves?
Okay, well, some pretty straightforward question, hopefully a straightforward answer. We had a cut to our duration exposure on the municipal market back in August when we saw that big rally. So the duration, we brought that in. We're focused a bit more on the short to intermediate part of the curve. Pretty, somewhat consistent, but even, less of a duration exposure, shorter on the curve. As a result of that rate rally, it's been a really interesting year in the muni market. Not unlike in the taxable market, where we've seen high yield bonds outperform the investment grade, the higher credit quality names. That's also played out in the municipal market. But when you had that big rally in treasuries that we saw in August, and it was on this fears of a hard landing and a recession, That's when the taxable treasury market that typically outperforms. So if for some reason we were to see a move higher in yields from here, well, then that would likely, we think, probably position muni investors better by being a bit more shorter duration.
Excellent. Yeah. Thanks, Kurt. Mm-hmm. And that soft landing is still on the table as far as our thinking at CIO is concerned.
That soft landing is very much on the table.
Right.
Yeah.
Are we circling the airport or are we approaching the runway?
Right.
You kind of use this analogy. I can overuse the analogy all day here. Maybe that's not a question for this forum, but we say a soft landing is definitely in the cards as of right now.
I mean, when you contrast it to the way that we were talking about the economy, and I say we, just sort of generally speaking, in 2023, mm-hmm. That was a year where it seemed like the consensus was for a recession. Fed rate hikes were going to almost without question lead to a recession because there was this trade-off. You could either curtail inflation and have better growth, or you could bring inflation down and you'd have to imperil the economy
right.
in the process.
It certainly was the question on everyone's minds at that point, and it was also coming up again last month when we
right.
saw that spike in volatility.
I mean, and there's still more to come. The policy rate, as we said before, is restrictive. But compared to the fears of 2023, I would say that this Fed has more or less stuck the landing.
Mm-hmm.
This is, I think, a pretty important point here to make, which mm-hmm. is soft landing relative to the fears of what higher rates would do back a year and a half ago. I think this is a pretty good job.
Yeah, excellent. One last question, David, for you. And the question is, excluding big tech, is what else is fairly valued at the moment?
Is everything else fairly valued? It seems like maybe the question is, are there opportunities outside of big tech?
Perhaps.
I would say, so look, I think, you know, we did a lot of discussion on the Fed rate cuts.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the interest rate sensitive parts of the economy could get a nice boost from potential Fed rate cuts. So, yeah, we do think companies within the housing space look interesting. We have a theme out there on housing recovery. I mentioned we upgraded financials. I mean, financials would be a beneficiary. You know, you get lower funding costs from those lower Fed funds rate, lower deposits that we're going to have probably a lower interest rate on our deposits. That's probably good news for many of the banks. We could start to see a pickup in loan growth, especially corporate loans, which have been pretty weak actually. Largely because the cost of borrowing is so high. So if that starts coming down, we could see a pickup there. Capital markets activity has begun recovering. That will likely continue going into the next year. So, yeah, that's an area also where we do see some opportunity. So, yeah, I would be looking for, our general framework is you want to be looking for where we're going to see better earnings performance and earnings revisions. And I think some of those, I do think you'll see that still in tech, but there definitely are other areas of the market where we could see that, housing, financials, mm-hmm. Other parts of cyclicals as well. But we want to have some balance in our allocations.
What about the energy equity sector? Since crude oil, WTI crude, is at a multi-month low at $69 a barrel. Obviously, you watch some of these TV programs that I won't name that put the red stuff all over the screen.
Yeah.
The sky is falling when it comes to crude oil.
Right.
And if you're investing in companies that are based in the energy space, any concerns there?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's more challenging, right? So we're neutral on energy.
The operative word for the times we're in, challenging.
We're challenging times for energy companies, better for consumers, right? So,
yeah.
As everybody...
We all like to pay less at the pump.
Exactly.
Right.
And as you were pointing out earlier, we're heating into winter and, heating bills and things like that. But, oil prices do look, on the low side. We think that there's scope for them to rise from here. But I also think it's important to bear in mind that we still have a lot of excess supply that is being held off the market by OPEC. And I think that's going to keep a cap on oil prices to some extent, just because the market knows that these mm-hmm. barrels are out there and OPEC would like to bring them back at some point when they have the opportunity. So, yeah, we could see a bounce in oil prices, but you know, not clear to us that that's going to be a kind of consistent outperformer in terms of energy equities. We don't see that as a consistent outperformer within the equity market.
Great. Thank you both. I wish we had more time. I've been really enjoying our conversation today, but I really want to thank you both for sitting down with me and talking to our audience on this live show. Kurt Ryman, David Lefkowitz, thanks, guys. Good to see you. Yeah,
thanks. You too.
Great. And thank you all for joining us. We appreciate you tuning in and, of course, sending in those questions. If we didn't get to your question, someone will follow up with you, or, again, you can talk to your financial advisor. Don't forget that the next monthly live stream will be taking place on Thursday, October 3rd. At the same time, 1 p.m. Eastern time. And until then, make sure you are checking out all of our websites, including our insights page, ubs.com/views. Lots of content up there from our chief investment office, including our House View publications, CIO alerts, blogs, and more. Plus, we've got all the multimedia you can fit into your daily life. We've got videos, we've got podcasts, we've got election series. So make sure you're checking out everything on that website and sort of follow the prompts to get all the content that you are interested in consuming. Thanks, everybody. And as always, please talk to your financial advisor. Until next time, I'm Anthony Pastore. Thank you for joining us. See you soon.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management Business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/working with us. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.